Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Montevideo Brief, a Thomas Gray novel, by J.H. Galanta. Read by John Lee. Prologue. February 16th, 1804, at the mouth of Tripoli Harbour. After winning her revolution, the United States had lost the protection of the Royal Navy, and her merchant fleet quickly became a plaything for pirates. In deference to a public desire not to have any sort of standing military, the American Navy was kept small and used infrequently. Then, in November of 1803, Barbary pirates seized one of America's few warships, USS Philadelphia, and turned her into a floating battery in Tripoli Harbour. The United States might have followed the European powers, all of whom had lost ships and crews to the Barbary pirates, and either paid the Pasha's tribute or abandoned Philadelphia's men to slavery. Instead, the humiliating seizure of Philadelphia became the blow which spurred the U.S. to stop turning the other cheek. From the start of the 19th century, American naval power was, in the main, confined to just six American-built heavy frigates. With so small a navy, the United States decided to deal with the Tripolitans by playing their strong suit, irregular warfare. The job of attending to Tripoli was left to the retinue of the third of the six frigates, USS Constitution. To defeat the Tripolitans, Constitution landed eight Marines on the shores of Tripoli, east of the city proper, and then dispatched a single ketch into Tripoli's harbour. The Marines' job was to orchestrate a surprise attack from the rear. The job of the ketch, named Intrepid and commanded by Stephen Decatur, was to blow up Philadelphia, opening the city to a naval bombardment from the front. As Intrepid passed the mole and entered Tripoli's inner harbour, Decatur gave the helm to his Maltese pilot. With only a single reef shaken out of the small mainsail, their way was slow. Decatur waited till Intrepid was just a few dozen yards from Philadelphia's main chains, then signalled for the Maltese pilot to make his hail.
"Ahoy the frigate!" said the pilot in Arabic. "We have just sailed through a terrible great blow." This was true, in fact. The weather in the southern Mediterranean had been filthy. "And we've lost our bowers. Can we make fast to you till daybreak?"
Dim sounds of discussion floated down from Philadelphia's quarterdeck. From an American intelligence man inside Tripoli, Decatur knew that Philadelphia's magazine was stocked and her guns manned and ready to be run out. If her crew conceived the slightest notion of what Intrepid was up to, the little ketch would instantly be reduced to splinters and driftwood. But after a few moments' talk, word came down from the quarterdeck, granting permission for Intrepid to seize herself to Philadelphia. As she sailed closer, Decatur could see that Philadelphia's gun ports were open. Philadelphia threw Intrepid a line so she could pull herself alongside. At the same time, a voice began to shout in Arabic. Decatur spoke no Arabic, but was able to pick out the word Americanos. In a calm and steady voice, Decatur gave the order. "Hold fast, men! Wait on my word." 10 very long seconds followed, with the Tripolitans beginning to run out the guns and the Americans heaving Intrepid closer and closer to Philadelphia's hull. There was the low peal of wood hitting wood, and Decatur shouted, "Now, boys, let's take her!" He was the first man to leap from Intrepid onto Philadelphia's side, grabbing hold of her main chains and pulling himself upward. Philadelphia's main deck was 12 feet higher than Intrepid's, but Decatur's crew, with the skill of able seamen, rushed up her side like so many monkeys. Some went in through the gunports, others over the gunwales, and in seconds the ship was a frenzied battlefield. To keep the affair quiet as possible, the Americans carried no guns. The fighting was hand-to-hand and saber-to-scimitar and brutal. In a desperate, bloody battle that lasted less than 5 minutes, the Americans killed 20 Tripolitans and took one prisoner. The rest went over the side, swimming for shore, shouting for help, and a counter-attack. Decatur could see a boat at quayside loading with palace guards, pushing off, pulling towards them. Soon they would have to repel boarders. Behind him, lanterns were handed up from Intrepid, 8 in all. They were handed out and Decatur gave the order, "Go the fire teams!" 8 two-man teams spilled down the hatchways. Each man had studied drawings of the ship and knew just where he was headed. 5 to storerooms, one to the gunroom, one to the berth deck, and one to the cockpit. Each fire team had its fire, its lantern, carried by one man, while the other carried turpentine-soaked rags and a 3-inch spermaceti candle. The rags were placed, and the candles readied. Decatur checked each room and then shouted for all to hear.
Fire!
The candles were lit from the lanterns and dropped on the rags. The firemen beat a hasty retreat to the main deck. Decatur followed them up. As expected, Philadelphia's harbour-bound dry timbers lit explosively. Decatur barely escaped the columns of fire pouring up from the hatches.
Back to Intrepid!
Shouted Decatur over the roaring fire, and all hands began to climb and jump back to the ketch, which was already spreading sail. Decatur was last aboard, dropping down onto Intrepid's deck and giving the order to cast off Philadelphia's line. The line caught, and Decatur cut it free with his saber. Men seized oars and pushed off the burning hulk, but the fire created a powerful backdraft, and even rowing for their lives, Intrepid's crew couldn't escape the pull. Decatur grabbed the tiller and turned Intrepid's bow back towards Philadelphia, filling her sails, and then tacked away just short of the fire. And then she was sailing large and flying up the harbour channel towards the waiting Constitution. Not a single American had been killed or wounded. On shore, an American intelligence man named Philo Parker watched the inferno and stroked his beard. The beard was an unaccustomed addition to the moustache he wore normally. It was part of his disguise as a Moroccan Jew on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Behind his beard and robes, Parker had gathered all the information Constitution and Decatur could require regarding the harbour, the currents and prevailing winds, the gunboats and batteries, and the manning of the captured frigate. These data were written in lime juice over a prefabricated Arabic letter and delivered to Constitution by way of the Danish consul in Tripoli, Nicholas Nissen. As Parker watched, the Philadelphia's magazine exploded. The blast nearly knocked him off his feet. A few hundred yards to his right, every pane of glass in the Pasha's palace shattered. In the morning, with Constitution looming at the harbour mouth and no Philadelphia to stop her, the Pasha of Tripoli sued for peace. Parker took charge of redeeming the Philadelphia crewmen, who'd already been sold as slaves. He was also obliged to inform the 8 commando marines that, with Tripoli already capitulated, they were obliged to disband the small army they'd raised and give back the pirate city they'd captured. Derna, it was called. The marines hadn't intended to capture it, but when they'd requested innocent passage, its potentate responded with the challenge, "My head or yours." A month later, Parker would read in a Gibraltar newspaper that Horatio Nelson had called the destruction of Philadelphia the most bold and daring act of the age. Then, at breakfast, Parker glanced over the paper's summary of the event, chuckled to himself, and buttered a scone. 1. June 9th, 1804. Vienna. The Grand Festival Hall, so-called, of the Palais Lobkowitz, had been filled with about 200 chairs, all facing the east end of the room, where an orchestra were tuning their instruments. Thomas Gray was seated in the last row, watching a tempestuous conductor walking among his musicians, stopping here and there to make some remark to one of them, once grabbing an oboe from a frightened-looking member of the woodwinds and proceeding to tune it himself, before handing it back with undisguised contempt. He looked to be about Gray's age. Actually, he was a decade older. Though Gray had never before seen him in the flesh, he knew the man well by reputation. He was shorter than Gray had imagined, quite short, if he'd been an Englishman, still somewhat short for a European, at about 5'3". His close-cropped, forward-combed hair made him look something like a Roman consul who'd accidentally been dressed in a high-collared coat over an even higher-collared shirt, brown breeches, and high black jackboots. The conductor's height, notwithstanding, there exuded from him an aura of command that put Gray in mind of Gray's chief, the head of the British Secret Service, Sir Edward Banks, though perhaps that had something to do with both men wearing their own hair. Even Gray, who preferred to follow Sir Edward's example in eschewing wigs, was wearing one this evening, so as not to stand out among a crowd of Vienna's elite. These particular elite were friends and friends of friends of the 7th Prince Lobkowitz, Josef Franz Maximilian. Gray's invitation had been obtained by, or, it would be more accurate to say, purloined from, Vienna's British consul, who parted with it reluctantly and with considerable irritation. Prince Lobkowitz was Europe's most famous patron of music, and the evening was to be the private debut of the newest composition of his most famous protégé, Ludwig van Beethoven. Apparently, the symphony, Beethoven's third, had been named, by Beethoven himself, the Sinfonia Bonaparte. In a city where Napoleon was, as a rule, either disliked or hated, it was a bold statement. But Beethoven had the stature to do as he liked, and Gray assumed he didn't know Napoleon's work the way Gray did. This thought brought Gray back to his purpose in attending the concert. He was here to take possession of an extremely expensive article, purchased, half in advance, half on delivery, from the Spanish ambassador to the Kingdom of Prussia, who, well known in German circles for his love of modern music, was a frequent guest at the private concerts of Prince Lobkowitz. Prior to his elevation to ambassador, he had been one of the secretaries of the Prince of Peace, Manuel Godoy. From serving as a trusted advisor of Spanish King Charles IV, Godoy had effectively taken complete control of Spain and its government. His title, Prince of Peace, came from his frequent involvement in the negotiations of peace treaties among the European powers. In 1802, he had negotiated the Treaty of Amiens, a brief peace between France and Britain. After the negotiations concluded, Napoleon sent a disgusted letter to Charles IV, calling Godoy the true King of Spain, and informing the oblivious Charles that his wife, Queen Maria Luisa, was Godoy's mistress. So strong was Godoy's grip on Spain that when his bodyguard intercepted the letter in the king's mail, Godoy not only allowed it to be delivered, but allowed it to become an article of court gossip. Shortly after Amiens, Godoy had negotiated a secret treaty between Spain and France. At the time, the two countries had an outstanding peace agreement under which Spain agreed to remain neutral in exchange for an assurance from Napoleon that he would not cross the Pyrenees. In the 2 years since Amiens, it had taken British intelligence enormous effort to confirm that there was a secret treaty, to learn then the names of the small group of Spaniards and Frenchmen who were privy to its contents, and then to identify one of these who would be amenable to unveiling the treaty in exchange for a great deal of money. One of Gray's colleagues in Spain had, at great length, identified as the best candidate Fernandino Maria Basco y Anda. Among his other duties as one of Godoy's private secretaries, Basco had been a courier of drafts between the negotiating parties when they met, in early 1803, in San Ildefonso, and he had been chosen to write fair a copy of the final document. Tonight, Basco y Anda, who, like most Spaniards, found the almost fantastic arrogance of Godoy highly objectionable, would accept the second half of his bribe and disclose the secret compact. At the ambassador's unwavering insistence that nothing be put in writing, Gray would receive the information by word of mouth. Gray felt mild guilt at having been chosen for this most pleasant of assignments. Colleagues of his in Iberia and the Holy Roman Empire had spent years working towards the elucidation of the secret treaty, but here Gray was, the man at the command performance, where the maestro of the orchestra was the maestro himself. Gray had been chosen for the job for no more complex a reason than his facility with language. He spoke German better than his colleagues in Spain, and Spanish better than his colleagues in Germany.
"There's an extra horn," said an elderly, ill-looking man, now seated beside Gray. He'd been escorted into the hall by several attendants, one of whom supported him while the rest cleared the way for him to process to the front of the room. The man, conducting them with his cane, made it clear he would go no farther than the last row, where Gray rose and helped the unfamiliar man into a seat. The attendants, some of whom must have been in the man's employ, and others of whom wore the livery of the House of Lobkowitz, had hovered momentarily, like hummingbirds at a hyacinth, looking anxious. With a gracious smile and a polite but expressly firm tone, the man had said to them, "Raus, bitte!" And then to their hurt faces, "Danke schön, meine Kinder." "There's an extra horn," he'd said in English. Gray wondered what Anglicism had given him away, though with the British consul's invitation in hand, he was not incognito. "I'm afraid I don't know enough of music to see it,"
said Gray, in German. The man answered again in English.
Do you mind if we speak in English? I haven't in some while, and I like to stretch the old muscles.
Of course, sir. But I am prevented. They are beginning. See? The man pointed with an uncomfortable, swollen finger towards the front of the room. Beethoven was centred before the orchestra, facing the audience. At English concerts, Gray had seen modern orchestras conducted in the new style of Haydn, using a baton rather than a staff. Here in Haydn City it was unsurprising to see Beethoven doing the same. Facing the audience, with the long baton in his hand, he looked like an assassin holding a long dagger, prepared to cut, without passion, someone's throat. With a slightly slow stroke, left to right, he silenced the audience. His voice was deep, particularly for a man of his height, and it commanded the complete attention of everyone in the room. He spoke in German.
No doubt, over the course of the evening, you have had, or will have, a chance to thank His Serene Highness, the Prince Lobkowitz, for his grace in creating this evening.
Gray could see the prince, seated at the centre of the first, hemicircular row, in a throne of modest extravagance.
I must add my own deep thanks. To you, he is prince. To me, he is something even greater. A patron. He does me great honour in his patronage. I hope it will prove some honour in return that I dedicate to him my Sinfonia Bonaparte.
Dedicating a piece to one man, while naming it after another, struck Gray as mildly absurd, but he wasn't familiar with the professional conventions of music. In any case, the audience, Gray included, stood to applaud the prince for having won this dedication. This went on for about a quarter minute before the prince waved for everyone to resume his seat and extended an open hand towards Beethoven, telling him he might begin. Beethoven nodded and turned to face the orchestra. He raised his baton over his head. It was pointed directly upward, then brought it down violently, and the orchestra struck the first chord. From the first instant, the music threw everyone in the room off balance. After a very short pause, the same giant chord was struck again. The audience waited for the second repetition. The natural feeling, Gray's in any case, was for a natural set of three. But instead, the theme began. An exceptionally simple theme, so simple that Gray, as he was no student of music, recognized it as a seesaw back and forth through a simple major triad. It sounded almost pastoral, but as it ended, the theme crashed into a C-sharp. In his chest, Gray felt the building of a sense of unease, as if the entire emotion built up by an opera, by a Don Giovanni, the tension of the statue of the Commendatore dragging Giovanni to hell, had been squeezed into a dozen notes. And then the music was back to its harmless, pastoral, major triad. Gray cocked his head to one side, an unconscious movement of confusion that bordered on concern. He felt the tension of the audience around him. The theme built up, from the almost thin sound of a horn to the whole orchestra, and exploded again. And now the theme was broken up, and strung over individual blasts of music with concussive pauses between them. And then the flutes, harmlessly playing the pastoral again, only to be beaten back by the angry horns asserting a furious rushing recapitulation, sliding through a second theme into a third, this one soft and smooth and comforting. The music danced from deep bass to high treble, was quiet, and then built up again to the booming reworking of the original theme mixed with the new ones, and more stabs of the orchestra with abrupt pauses. And then another new theme? Or just the descent back towards the original? Now the stabs had no pauses between them, and a repetition of the theme was played by the full orchestra, with the jarring, sharp note now omitted. This time it was triumphant, as if Haydn or Mozart had written it, fiery and energetic, but familiar. The tension in Gray's chest eased somewhat. The music pulled him along like an 8-in-hand team of wild horses, but now they were running over ground he recognized. The strings danced to the forefront of the music, playfully, then building to another giant but natural restating of the theme. The tempo began to slow dramatically, like a boat coasting slowly up to a pier. And then the original theme burst back in a low register, not over fast, but
but full of some powder waiting to detonate. And now the playful strings sounded less playful, dancing on top of the deep theme, the trivial but very deep original theme now passing through different chords, different triads. Colours flashed through Gray's head with each variation. Stabs, now, again, fragments of the alternate themes dueling with the principal. And then, from nowhere, a key change, or so Gray thought, and a new wandering, scalish theme. Gray didn't know, couldn't find the correct words with which to describe it to himself. The deep strings and the high horns were fighting, not with each other, but beside each other, like two men shoulder to shoulder on a barricade. The horns pulled back, and strings began to play a sort of vamp, and very quietly. A horn player entered too early, playing the original theme. A mistake? And then, a moment later, the whole orchestra was playing the theme again. Was there another key change? Gray couldn't follow it. The music bombarded the room like a broadside from HMS Victory. A rolling broadside, actually, and with Victory fighting both sides, as she had at St. Vincent. Then peace, flutes, quiet, and then building, speeding back towards some theme. The same chord, over and over, then back to the theme. Another new key? Or just a new chord? And the strings were playing their own playful reordering of the pastoral, new and flighty, non-committal. And then another build-up. All the cannon firing at once, and a new version of the theme, doubling the second to the last note, excluding the last. Stabbing, giant chords. Dun, dun, doon. The first movement ended, and Gray felt as if he'd been punched in the face. He'd never heard anything like this before, but he had no time to consider it before the second movement began. It was slow, quiet and mournful. A dirge, a wailing from the horns. The theme from the first movement went unstated, but lingered at the edges. There was an echo of it. It was a ghost, and this was its funeral music. The music built up, in Gray's mind, along those lines, as if it were a choir of mourners gradually swelled by new arrivals. There was a moment of flickering anxiety. The mourners were standing on the edge of a cliff, looking down into a chasm, wondering if they'd fall headlong into it, backing away, choosing to absent themselves from Felicity a while. And then they were reassembling, a brigade of mourners, or, as Gray saw it now, a brigade in mourning, which had now to put grief behind it and begin to think of the next battle, and now to march towards it. Was this the French army or the Austrian? Perhaps both. Flickers of optimism broke through, sun through clouds, but the clouds were still there, a new march tempo. Was the pastoral theme back? Something was wrong with it. It felt upside down. It was quiet, very quiet. The army was disappearing over the horizon, and then it was gone. And then the third movement rushed in, water through a floodgate. Boys running alongside the triumphant army as it marched home, falling in step with the soldiers, holding sticks like swords and muskets. It was joyous, triumphal, with small hints of menace lurking beneath, quickly stamped away by the joy of the revelers. Wives rushing to greet their husbands, the slowing of the pace, greeting friends, accepting drinks, and then building up again to triumph, as the men went into their own homes with their own families, with their wives, and then shut their doors behind them. As quickly as it had flooded in, the third movement was over. And a dizzying descent down a new theme into the fourth movement, a low plucking of the music, a farmer's dancing echo of the symphony's theme, a cheerful, expressive recapitulation, though again with hints of occasional minor menace, and then outright menace, like one of those Slavic sword dances. From where had the Slavs come? But still there was considerable joy in the music. Maybe these were the sounds of the festival in the town square to celebrate the army's return. The music was spreading out into thick, broad harmonies, and then stabs, painful stabs of dissonance, and a new tempo, rapid, a rapid walking pace, ready to break into a run, but holding itself back. And the joy was peeling away. A sort of grim sang-froid was setting in. It was neither happy nor sad, just forceful. And then it finally did break into its run, and the triumph returned. With the music running, bounding over obstacles, its sword raised high in the air, leading troops of music behind it. And then it was over. Grey felt slightly intoxicated. He let out the breath he'd been holding and shook his head. He looked over at the elderly man sitting beside him. The man's face was a curious mix of wonderment and unsurprise.
"I've never heard anything like that before," said Grey.
"No," said the man, "no one has."
The applause was muted and brief, and yet as the crowd rose to its feet, allowing footmen to clear the chairs and quickly return the auditorium to a festival hall, a dense pack began to form around Beethoven, everyone wanting a word or a shake of the hand of the famous composer. Beethoven nodded politely, though unsmilingly, to several people, but spoke only to Prince Lobkowitz. Then he turned and walked through the orchestra and disappeared into some private side room. The prince said something to those who'd been anxious for Beethoven's attention, then followed after Beethoven with a simply dressed man of about 20 beside him. Grey turned away from the fuss to help the old man beside him to his feet, but saw the man's attendants had already returned. One of them, more or less inadvertently, elbowed Grey as he rushed to take the old man's arm. On a normal evening, Grey might have made a point of this, but feeling as he did, he simply backed away and removed a cigarillo case from his pocket. The young man who'd accompanied the Prince Lobkowitz towards Beethoven's withdrawal now appeared again and spoke something into the ear of the old man, who nodded and, waving his attendants away, using only his cane, began to walk forward with the young man beside him, presumably towards the prince and Beethoven. Grey wondered who the man was, but didn't have time to dwell on the question. He had a rendezvous to effect. One side of the hall was studded with French doors that opened onto a low terrace. Grey opened one and stepped out into the warm night, leaving the bustle of the party behind. Footmen had started to appear with trays of champagne. Grey lit a cigarillo and waited. A few minutes later, he heard one of the doors open behind him, releasing a flood of party sounds onto the terrace. Grey turned. It was the young man who had escorted the old man and the prince. Could he possibly be the Spanish ambassador to Prussia? Grey very much doubted it, but all the same gave the passphrase to make certain. "May I offer you a cigarillo, sir?" he said in German.
"Oh, why yes, thank you. Very kind," said the man in German.
This was not the correct countersign. Had he been Grey's rendezvous, he should have said, "No, I am not in the smoking vein." So who was this man? Grey held out his case for the man to take one of the long, thin cigars. "I enjoy trying different blends," he said, as Grey ignited a match for him. "It's a sort of proxy for seeing the world." He smiled.
"Thank you, Mr. Blake. Thomas Blake."
Grey used his pseudonym of the night and offered his hand. The young man shook it.
"Ferdinand Ries."
Grey nodded, and for a moment they smoked in silence, both looking back towards the party.
"I couldn't help but notice you speaking to the prince," said Grey after a moment.
"Yes," said Rhys. "Well, not speaking, perhaps. Delivering a message. I am Herr von Beethoven's secretary."
"Ah," said Grey, "that must be a most fascinating employment."
"It is, sir. I am also one of his pupils."
"I didn't realize he taught."
"Yes," said Rhys, "though not regularly. In fact, I am his only student at the moment, which is how I was pressed into secretarial duty. Herr von Beethoven was briefly a student of my father's in Bonn, and Beethoven does not forget favours."
Grey nodded.
"Do you mind if I ask you who the elderly gentleman was, whom I sat beside during the concert? I saw that you escorted him off as well."
Rhys looked slightly surprised, only for a moment, and then, after taking a pull on the cigarillo, said,
"That was the composer, Herr Haydn."
"Haydn?" said Grey. "Well, I'll be goddamned. Pardon me. I wish I had known."
"I gather you're not a German," said Rhys.
"I'm English," said Grey.
Rhys nodded.
"Of course. Haydn was in your country for many visits. But, of course, I should not make the vulgar mistake of assuming anyone has had the unearned luck that I have had in making the acquaintance of some of these great men."
Grey nodded.
sensible fellow.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?